Hi, I'm Doug Keck, and welcome to The Catholic Sphere. You know, each week we bring you an insightful discussion on the latest issues facing the Catholic Church and the culture we live in from a theological perspective. Today we're asking, war, what is it good for? Here to answer that question, we have EWTN TV and radio host, the ubiquitous Father Mitch Pacwa. He joins us from his Scripture and Tradition set right here in Irondale, Alabama. We also have EWTN's Vice President of Theology. That's Colin Donovan. He's always on this program. He is in our theology studio. Once again, finally, we're joined by the host of EWTN Radio's Call to Communion, also seen on television, Dr. David Anders. He joins us from the radio studio. So welcome, gentlemen. Thank you for finding time for the Catholic Sphere on this panel. And we have a big topic, really, because it's one with the headlines in the news, obviously, in the first part of this year, the idea of war and what is it good for? The answer back in 1970 was nothing, obviously, thanks to a song. And obviously at the height, Father Mitch, of when there was the Vietnam War. So it was totally understandable. What is the Catholic position when it comes to things like war? And the question is, are Catholics pacifists, or is there some time where war is justified?
Yeah, war is something that is considered an objective evil because so many things happen in war. It typically gets out of control of the people who plan it. And it's something that we decry, we don't want, and there's an obligation for every Christian to do what's ever possible to prevent a war from starting, because once it starts, it takes on its own dynamic. Mm-hmm. However, there are cases where going to war becomes necessary, unfortunately. There are plenty of examples of that. Certainly in the 20th century, World War II was a classic example. And that in order to save more lives in the face of this terrible dictatorship, you have to fight. Now, there are also circumstances where even more lives were being taken by the Soviet Union's government, and still more lives were being taken in the People's Republic of China, the Communist Chinese. But there's another principle involved. Is going to war going to cause more death, or is it going to prevent death? So there, which brings up that there are certain rules for engagement in war when it is a last effort. And these are the kind of things we keep in balance.
Let me ask you, Dr. Anders, it seems somewhat straightforward. You know, you get attacked by the Japanese at Pearl Harbor. It seems like you have the ability to respond. I don't think there was anybody who would think that that was out of bounds from a church perspective. I think there was actually one woman who voted against declaring war, as I recall, in World War II. But otherwise, it was pretty well understood. But what do you do in a situation where you're dealing with, let's say, right now, and in other situations where there's this kind of concept of preventative war, of that you're trying to stop somebody from doing something that ultimately will be catastrophic, but they haven't done it yet?
You know, the Catechism of the Catholic Church doesn't directly address that question, but it seems to imply an answer in saying that the aggressor nation, it has to be a response to an aggressor nation, where the harm is grave, certain, and lasting, and it is really up to policymakers to make a prudential judgment about whether or not the conflict under consideration meets that description. Now, obviously, the Vicar of Christ on Earth has the right and the duty to weigh in that prudential judgment, and Catholics have an obligation to give their religious submission and mind and will to the Pope's judgment. So, you know, we're not left as individual citizens to try to just necessarily vote our opinions on this. I mean, there are policymakers who have the task to make those determinations, and the Holy See and the bishops of the Catholic Church obviously are allowed to weigh in.
Right. Well, Colin, let me ask you, as a son of St. Thomas Aquinas, and talking about the idea of what's been called the just war theory, why don't you explain that so we understand that from a Catholic perspective?
Well, from the Catholic perspective, as explained to me by the good Dominicans at the Angelicum back in the 1980s, the church arrived at that by a very slow process. Because during the first three centuries, there was a general prohibition against bloodshed. Bloodshed was not distinguished between seemingly justifiable or unjustifiable. But rather, there was a kind of Catholic pacifism by which during the early centuries, if you took the life of another person for whatever reason, you went and did the grand penance required for restoration to the church, the Lent, and then the confession at before Easter. And so the church had a very hard view of this. Mm. And in a way, it was trying to reconcile two things, and that is the obvious call to live a life of perfection that is in the Gospels, is particularly in the Sermon Mount, be perfect as the Heavenly Father is perfect, turn the other cheek, and these kinds of references in the Sacred Scripture. But also the admonition of, you know, Christ to his apostles, you know, to have a sword when they traveled. But then when the time came to use it, he said, put it away. So the early church had to interpret what this meant, and it took a very strong position in the first 330 years, basically, on this view. And we start to see a change on that. It persisted under fathers like St. Ambrose, who, on the one hand, recognized the early history of the church and that position both with respect to war and capital punishment, but on the other hand, acknowledge that sometimes things have to be done in view of justice. And then it was fully taken up by Augustine, taking a position from the writings of Cicero on what constituted the justus bellum, the just war. And so in deciding what had to be just, originally it was understood, remember, we've come from a time when the church was pagan and persecuted, the empire was pagan and persecuting the church, to a time when the empire was now being made up of Christians, and Christians were in positions, and they had to defend the empire. And the defense of the empire in the Middle Ages, or during the beginning of those ages, became also a defense of the church. And so the idea of a just war, a war of defense against the aggressor, prosecuted obviously morally and justly, done in a way pure of heart. This is mentioned multiple times in various fathers, and Athanasius, and Augustine, and Basil, and others, but prosecuted in that way with the right motives, with a pure heart, and for the defense of empire or nation and the church. What we have seen in the 20th century was a change from that. And it began really with Benedict XV and the First World War and the idea of absolute war. And he fought, you know, morally and spiritually for finding peace in that situation and arguing against the use of war when war was so devastating. And really, the popes of the 20th century have continued to foster that attitude. And I think it's a prophetic attitude in a way, as Christian culture declines more and more and secular culture becomes more pagan, as then Father Ratzinger said in the 1940s. In that context, in a way, we're being returning to the time of the early church, and we ought to have very careful considerations of questions like war or even of capital punishment. And the popes have encouraged us to have that thoughtfulness.
So, Father Mitch, based on what Colin just talked about there, would seem to be that basically Catholics were pacifists up until the, you know, they were impacted by the Roman, Constantine, and then things changed and we adapted because we were part of an administration. So is it that we really should be treating it that way? I mean, I think it's understood that people would think, of course, nobody wants war, and the Holy Father obviously says, you know, even with what's going on now, he doesn't see this as something that could be justified. But what is a Catholic to think? Is it really supposed to be that, you know, Jesus in one hand says you need a sword, bring it with you, but don't use it?
Yeah, there are also responsibilities that we have to citizens. As a classic example, after Pearl Harbor was bombed and then Adolf Hitler declared war The Third Reich declared war against us just a day or two later. And there are our own citizens that we have an obligation to protect, people who are innocent, especially in that case, both the Imperial Japanese Army and the Army of the Third Reich were strongly committed to racial cleansing. The Japanese did that in China and in Southeast Asia. Well, of course, we're well aware of what Hitler was doing in Europe against Jews, Gypsies, and others. So, you know, do we have a right to defend ourselves and those who are too vulnerable to be able to defend themselves? The church says yes. And it's not just that we can justify acquiring power. That would be wrong. And, you know, there have been plenty of wars fought by various Christian nations just to get more land. That's not justified. And taking from other people is not justified. But defending those who cannot possibly defend themselves, that is justified, especially in the face of responding to aggression from somebody else, as in the case of the Empire of Japan and Nazi Germany.
So, Dr. Anders, as I alluded to with the Holy Father's statement, otherwise recently, former Attorney General Bill Barr was speaking at a conference in Napa, and he made the point. They said, it's very easy to stand back and say, turn the other cheek or take an absolutist position. You shouldn't be violent, he said. But that begs the question, that doesn't really solve the problem. And he's also obviously talking about this as a Catholic and the idea that, you know, of course the Holy Father says there shouldn't be this, but then the question is, are we really saying that the view of the church in the early days was basically lambs to the slaughter, that the church would not defend itself? Or was there the understanding that what, as Catholics or as Christians, we have a perspective, but that doesn't mean that that has to be the perspective of the government, whose responsibility is to protect the people, let's say, even in, whether it be Roman times or medieval times or even today?
So I want to make an observation about something that I felt, I think Jesus Christ brought to the world, whether you are a Catholic or not. And this is a point that I have encountered in a number of historians, and some quite recently, Catholic historians, non-Catholic historians, atheist historians. And that is that before the time of Christ, the idea that human beings had an inherent dignity and an equality before God and one another is an alien concept, right? I mean, even the ethicists that we have the most respect for in the ancient world, men like Aristotle, or we mentioned Cicero or Seneca, and we admire many things about their philosophies, did not have this concept, right? I mean, Aristotle famously thought that some men were naturally slaves because they were morally and spiritually inferior and therefore ought to be subjugated. One Roman philosopher, I forget which one, said, some nations can tolerate servitude, not Rome, right? He had a kind of ethnocentric justification for Roman imperialism. It is right that Rome should conquer, right? There was an epistolary exchange, and I forget which of the popes, that a pope made with one of the descendants of Genghis Khan, when the Mongolians were overrunning Eastern Europe and conquering Christian villages and enslaving people and killing them and pillaging. And so the pope sends an envoy and basically says, where do you get off attacking these people? They haven't done anything against you. They have no wrong that should be you know, redressed here. And the Khan writes back to the pope and basically says, I don't understand the question. They have stuff I want. You know, and so, you know, now we can speak in terms of human rights. We have the UN Declaration, which, of course, was authored in large measure by a Catholic, right? Jacques Maritain. And we can dialogue with non-Catholic peoples, whether they be atheists or Jews or Muslims or Buddhists or Hindus or whatever. And the world has changed its attitude, right? And to a large extent, I mean, you now have things like socially conscious Buddhists. You have Indians talking about human rights. This is a discourse that would never have happened in the world had Christianity not seeded the roots of human dignity across cultures, within the church to be sure, and across cultures. And so the concept of what a government owes to its people has been radically transformed by Jesus Christ. Now, when it comes to the question of war, one thing that's absolutely ruled out is that imperialistic conquest, because I think I have a moral right to take what's yours because I'm morally superior. That's ruled out for all peoples, right? But the idea that the oppressed, even in a foreign country, also have a dignity that I might justifiably seek to protect can bring in a motive for armed conflict in those conditions where the harm envisioned is grave, lasting, and certain, when I have a reasonably certain expectation of success, and the means that I use or my country uses to bring about that outcome are not going to cause harm greater than the grave, lasting harm that the aggressor nation has perpetrated. So, you know, in the context of Jesus's original teaching, the idea of Christians having civil dominion is just not on the table, right? I mean, the early church is operating in an environment where they're very much a minority position, and Jesus's teaching is oriented towards those who wish to enter the kingdom of heaven. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, many are called, few are chosen. The way is wide that leads to destruction, and many find it. The way is narrow that leads to life, and few find it. What do you do when you have the care of a community that is not made up of saints? How do you look to the dignity of unredeemed, ungracious people who wish to do harm to others that are their neighbors? It requires the church to think, honestly, not just about the narrow question of how do I enter the narrow way, but how do I protect the dignity of the poor and the alienated from those who have no interest in the narrow way?
Right. Right, absolutely. You can even look at sometimes, Colin, the idea, you know, we hear in the gospel the idea of they lived together and they shared with each other. And you could make a good case to say it was kind of a very socialistic kind of approach in the early days. And then it was found pretty much that it didn't work. So is that similar to some of the understanding of this pacifism?
No, I don't think it's exactly similar to. It does work. It's the idea of religious communities in the church, although one of the professors...
Right, but not as something, but that's a special call for a special group of people.
Right, and so the special call for a special group of people known as believers is, of course, as David mentioned, to seek the good and seek the good of other peoples, even if they're your enemies. Mm-hmm. And so that's an essential element of the question. There has been a doctrinal development in the church, and there's no question that the just war theory doctrine is such, as the Catechism lays it out. Mm-hmm. It sets down, if you look at it from the moral theology point of view, which was the specialty that I studied in Rome, and you look at it from that point of view, in a just war, the object is, or the end that you're accomplishing, going to war, the thing that you're doing must be just. The intention must be good, and the circumstances must be right. Mm-hmm. Some of this question has to do with the justice of going to war. And this was the point that I think has been made recently regarding the just war theory, and that is you have to have somebody who is an aggressor against you. Now, I think there's a lot of ways of definitionally looking at what aggression is, or whether it's, you know, penetrating your border with a tank, or whether it's other things done against you. And I think history will look at our times and make those judgment. Mm-hmm. But the element of the circumstances, and that is the conduct of the war and how it's done, these things also add up to whether the war was just and prosecuted justly. And so the circumstantial element, I think, also explains the situation of history, how the circumstantially the Christians did not only not have the possibility of going to war, there was much no question whatsoever of prosecuting it justly, and with time that has changed. And so I think we may be heading into a time when it's more like the first centuries, but yet we still have the responsibilities, as David mentioned, to do those things necessary to defend our country. But the point of the just war doctrine is that when we do so, we comply with that doctrine for our own good and for the good of others, and recognizing the dignity of others. The unusual circumstance of the age in which we've been living in since the First World War is the totality of war, especially with nuclear weapons in it. And I think the popes very rightly call attention to that aspect of it in order to make sure that people are very persnickety in the way they carry out war so as not to cause a greater danger. So that, too, is a circumstance which may clarify in particular cases whether this is a good war to go into or whether it isn't.
Right. Let me ask you, Father Mitch, because we have that idea of the difference maybe between self-defense and revenge, and are those the same things from a moral perspective? But also the idea somebody might say, well, your neighbor's over there, he's got a gun, and he's telling you he's going to shoot you as soon as he finishes filling the bullets in his gun. So should you wait for him to shoot at you before you respond, or do you do something else?
If he is putting bullets in his gun, tackle him. Mm-hmm. Because he can't shoot you. Mm-hmm. And you have the right to prevent that violence using a means appropriate and as nonviolent as possible, while at the same time still being effective.
Right. Okay.
This is something that is very important. And this is, that would be a simple case. Mm-hmm. In the case of nations, there are lots of other concerns because you can't tackle a tank division while they're loading their guns. So you have to make other applications here. I would also add something in terms of previous discussion about the first three centuries. Mm-hmm. Which of the wars of Rome were actually defensive in that period and the period before that? They had been extraordinarily aggressive over the centuries, and that aggression, say the war against the Persians and such, were very aggressive, and that would be a reason not to fight in the Roman army. Plus, to be a soldier in one of the legions meant you had to also worship the legion's god. That every legion carried a staff with an image on it. You had to worship. That's why Jews did not fight in the Roman army. Mm-hmm. They couldn't engage in those things. And Christians followed their example in that. So that's another factor. Whereas, by the time of the fifth century, the fourth and fifth century, you see the empire being invaded by very aggressive groups that were, and at sometimes, killing large numbers of citizens during the barbarian invasions, and that lasted for hundreds of years.
Mark, let me ask you, Dr. Anders. Some would point out that say that. You know, it's in weakness that one entices this aggression, and that by having a strong defense or and indicating that one's ability to respond is there, I got mutual sure destruction in the old days of MAD, keeps people from doing things that they shouldn't be doing.
Well, I mean, I think that's obvious, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if I'm I'm not an aggressive person, but if I were be, I would, if I would be aggressive, I would certainly not tackle the biggest guy in the room who's clear to take me out, you know.
Right.
But, you know, deterrence is a very different moral situation than aggression. I mean, you know, so, I mean, this is a policy question. My own personal preference would be to, as they say, speak softly and carry a really, really big stick and hopefully deter that aggression at the outset. I mean, that is one way to bring about diminishing conflict if people think there's no way they're going to win against you. Now, does that work? Does that count if you have an aggressor who is suicidally homicidal, right? Who doesn't care about the mutually assured destruction? Seems to me it worked in the Cold War because both sides had skin in the game and didn't want to end their civilizations. What about if you're up against a civilization that doesn't mind annihilating itself if it can take out what it perceives as, you know, an apocalyptic enemy? Mm-hmm. You might be in a different situation then.
Right, and if it believes that somehow there's some great reward at the end of that.
Right, if they have divine sanction for this suicidal attack.
That mitigates doing it and mitigates the fact that it's going to be better in the next life, so to speak.
I still think we ought to have deterrence in that situation, but it may not be as effective.
Right. Well, let me ask you, Colin, also, is there a situation of double effect that happens sometimes in these kind of situations with just war? Even the idea that maybe it might start out as being a just war but lead to something that becomes unjust over time.
Well, it can, and obviously this is why there are codes of conduct, the Geneva Convention, for example. All military officers get introduced to that matter. Those who go to senior command schools will look at that history more deeply, including the just war doctrine and so on, since that's such a part of Western civilization and the conduct of the European and the European-derived nations. So all of those things get looked at. So you do have to be careful about those things, because in the conduct of a war, individually, it's going to be, it could be the nation itself that acts badly, or it could be the individual soldier, sailor, airman, or marine who acts badly and is morally responsible for it. And I think, going back to something Father Mitch said too, the way the early church looked at this, it was very often what was in the heart of the believer. And there could be occasions where somebody who was a soldier, you know, left it and wished to convert, and then that was treated differently than a Christian who wanted to serve in the army. So there were a lot of considerations like that of the motive of the individual and the goodness of the effort, and a clear recognition that the Roman Empire did at times defend itself, and it was just then to fight on its behalf, in the individual case of the soldier who was actually in the army during those periods. And so the church looks at it much the same way today. The doctrine is there to encourage the beginning of the war rightly, and the other conventions are there to ensure its prosecution justly as well.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. We always want the Holy Father and the church standing up for peace. Of course, that's what we want. But there are prudential situations, and it makes it complicated. Thank you again, Father Mitch, Colin, and Dr. Anders, for being with us for this lively discussion. And we thank you for joining us. Don't forget to join us next week right here on the Catholic Sphere, where we'll bring you yet another topic dealing with theological issues and concerns in the Catholic Church. I'm Doug Keck. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.